The Horse Whisperer, Disc 3.
It was clever the way they handled her finding out about the leg, Grace thought. Because looking back on it, she couldn't actually pinpoint the moment that she knew. She supposed they had it down to a fine art, these things, and knew exactly how much dope to pump into you so you didn't freak out. She was aware something had happened down there, even before she could move or speak again. There was this strange feeling, and she noticed how the nurses seemed busier there than anywhere else. And it just seemed to slip into her consciousness, like many other facts, as they hauled her out of that tunnel of glue. "Going home?" She looked up. Leaning in at the door was the woman who came each day to see what you wanted to eat. She was vast and friendly, with a booming laugh capable of passing through bricks and mortar. Grace smiled and nodded. "All right, for some," the woman said. "Means you don't get to eat my Christmas dinner, mind. You can save me some. I'm coming back the day after tomorrow." Her voice sounded croaky. She still had a band-aid over the hole they had made in her neck for the respirator tube. The woman winked. "Honey, I'll do just that." She went, and Grace looked at her watch. It was still 20 minutes till her parents were due, and she was sitting on her bed, dressed and ready to go. They had moved her into this room a week after she'd come out of the coma, freeing her at last from the respirator so she could speak rather than just mouth. The room was small, with a terrific view of the parking lot, and painted that depressing shade of pale green they must make specially for hospitals. But at least there was a TV, and with every surface cluttered with flowers, cards, and presents, it was cheerful enough. She looked down at her leg, where the nurse had neatly pinned up the bottom half of her gray sweatpants. She'd once heard someone say that if you had an arm or a leg cut off, you could still feel it. And it was absolutely true. At night, it itched so badly, it drove her crazy. It itched right now. The weird thing was that even so, even as she looked at it, the funny half-leg they'd left her with didn't seem to belong to her at all. It was someone else's. Her crutches were propped against the wall by a bedside table, and peeping around them was the photograph of Pilgrim. It was one of the first things she'd seen when she came out of the coma. Her father had seen her looking at it and told her the horse was okay, and that made her feel better. Judith was dead. And Gully. They'd told her that, too. And it was just like it was with the leg. The news wouldn't quite sink in. It wasn't that she didn't believe it. Why, after all, would they lie? She had cried when her father broke it to her, but perhaps again because of the drug she was on, it hadn't felt like real crying. It was almost like watching herself cry. And since then, whenever she'd thought about it, and it was amazing to her how she managed not to, the fact of Judith's death seemed somehow to be suspended in her head, protectively encased so that she couldn't inspect it too closely. A police officer had come to see her last week and had asked her questions and taken notes about what had happened. The poor guy had looked so nervous, and Robert and Annie had hovered anxiously in case she got upset. They needn't have worried. She told him she could only remember things up to the point when they slid down the bank. It wasn't true. She knew that if she wanted to, she could remember much, much more. But she didn't want to. Robert had already explained that she would have to make some other statement later, a deposition or something for the insurance people, but only when she was better. Whatever that meant. Grace was still staring at the picture of Pilgrim. She had already decided what she was going to do. She knew they'd try and get her to ride him again, but she wasn't going to, ever. She would tell her parents to give him back to the people in Kentucky. She couldn't bear the idea of selling him locally where she might come across him one day being ridden by someone else. She would go and see him one more time to say goodbye. But that was all. Pilgrim came home for Christmas, too, a week earlier than Grace, and no one at Cornell was sad to see the back of him. He left tokens of his appreciation with several of the students. One now had her arm in plaster, and half a dozen others had cuts and bruises. Dorothy Chen, who had devised a kind of matador technique to give him his daily shots, was rewarded by a perfect set of teeth marks on her shoulder. "I can only see them in the bathroom mirror," she told Harry Logan. "They've gone through every shade of purple you can imagine." Logan could imagine. Dorothy Chen examining her naked shoulder in her bathroom mirror. Oh, boy. Joan Dyer and Liz Hammond came with him to pick the horse up. He and Liz had always got on well, despite having rival practices. She was a big, hearty woman of about his age, and Logan was glad to have her along because he always found Joan Dyer on her own a little heavy going. Joan, he guessed, was in her mid-50s and had that sort of stern, weathered face that always made you feel you were being judged. It was she who drove, apparently content to listen while Logan and Liz chatted about business. When they got to Cornell, she backed the trailer expertly right up to Pilgrim's stall. Dorothy got a shot of sedatives into him, but it still took them an hour to get him loaded in. These past weeks, Liz had been helpful and generous. When she got back from her conference, she'd come over to Cornell at the McLean's request. It was obvious they wanted her to take over from him, a sacrifice Logan would have been all too happy to make. But Liz reported back that Logan had done a great job and should be left to it. The compromise was that she was to keep a kind of watching brief. Logan didn't feel threatened. It was a relief to share notes about a difficult case like this. Joan Dyer, who hadn't seen Pilgrim since the accident, was shocked. The scars on his face and chest were bad enough, but this savage, demented hostility was something she'd never before seen in a horse. All the way back, for 4 long hours, they could hear him crashing his hooves against the sides of his box. They could feel the whole trailer shake. Joan looked worried. "Where am I going to put him?"
"What do you mean?" said Liz.
"Well, I can't put him back in the barn like this. It wouldn't be safe." When they got back to the stables, they kept him in the trailer while Joan and her 2 sons cleared one of a row of small stalls behind the barn that hadn't been used in years. The boys, Eric and Tim, were in their late teens and helped their mother run the place. Both, Logan noted as he watched them work, had inherited her long face and economy with words. When the stall was ready, Eric, the older and more sullen of the two, backed the trailer up to it. But the horse wouldn't come out. In the end, Joan sent the boys in through the front door of the trailer with sticks, and Logan watched them whacking the horse and saw him rear up against them. It didn't seem right, and Logan was worried about that chest wound bursting open, but he couldn't come up with a better idea, and at last the horse backed off down into the stall, and they slammed the door on him. As he was driving home that night to his wife and children, Harry Logan felt depressed. He remembered the hunter, that little guy in the fur hat, grinning down at him from the railroad bridge. The little creep was right, he thought. The horse should have been put down. Christmas at the McLean's started badly and got worse. They drove home from the hospital with Grace carefully bolstered across the back seat of Robert's car. They hadn't got halfway when she asked about the tree.
"Can we decorate it as soon as we get back?"
Annie looked straight ahead and left it to Robert to say they'd already done it, though not how it was done, in a joyless silence late the night before with the air between them bristling.
"Baby, I thought you wouldn't feel up to it," he said.
Annie knew she should feel touched or grateful for this selfless shouldering of blame, and it bothered her that she didn't. She waited, almost irritated, for Robert to leaven things with the inevitable joke. "And hey, young lady," he went on, "you're going to have enough work to do when we get home. There's firewood to cut, all the cleaning, food to prepare." Grace dutifully laughed, and Annie ignored Robert's sidelong look in the silence that followed. Once home, they managed to summon some little cheer. Grace said the tree in the hall looked lovely. She spent some time alone in her room, playing Nirvana loudly to reassure them she was all right. She was good on the crutches and could even handle the stairs, falling only once when she tried to bring down a bag of little presents she'd had the nurses go out and buy for her to give her parents.
"I'm okay,"
she said when Robert ran to her. She had banged her head sharply on the wall, and Annie, emerging from the kitchen, could see she was in pain.
"Are you sure?"
Robert tried to offer help, but she accepted as little as she could.
Yes, Dad, really, I'm fine.
Annie saw Robert's eyes fill as Grace went over and put the presents under the tree, and the sight made her so angry she had to turn and go quickly back into the kitchen. They always gave each other Christmas stockings. Annie and Robert did Grace's together and then one for each other. In the morning, Grace would bring hers into their room and sit on the bed, and they would take turns unwrapping presents, making jokes about how clever Santa Claus had been or how he'd forgotten to remove a price tag. Now, as with the tree, the ritual seemed to Annie almost unbearable. Grace went to bed early, and when they were sure she was asleep, Robert tiptoed to her room with the stocking. Annie undressed and listened to the hall clock ticking away the silence. She was in the bathroom when Robert came back, and she heard a rustling and knew he was pushing her stocking under her side of the bed. She had just done the same with his. What a farce it was. He came in as she was brushing her teeth. He was wearing his striped English pajamas and smiled at her in the mirror. Annie spat out and rinsed her mouth.
"You've got to stop this crying," she said without looking at him.
"What?"
"I saw you when she fell. You've got to stop feeling sorry for her. Pity won't help her at all."
He stood looking at her, and as she turned to go back into the bedroom, their eyes met. He was frowning at her, shaking his head. "You're unbelievable, Annie."
"Thanks.
What's happening to you?" She didn't reply, just walked past him back into the bedroom. She got into bed and switched off her light, and after he'd finished in the bathroom, he did the same. They lay with their backs to each other, and Annie stared at the sharp quadrant of yellow light that jutted in from the landing onto the bedroom floor. It wasn't anger that had stopped her answering him. She simply had no idea what the answer was. How could she have said such a thing to him? Perhaps his tears enraged her because she was jealous of them. She hadn't wept once since the accident. She turned and slipped her arms guiltily around him, putting her body to his back.
"I'm sorry," she murmured, and kissed the side of his neck.
For a moment, Robert didn't move. Then slowly he rolled onto his back and put an arm around her, and she nestled in with her head on his chest. She felt him give a deep sigh, and for a long time they lay still. Then she slid her hand slowly down his belly and gently took hold of him and felt him stir. Then she rose up and knelt above him, pulling her nightgown over her head and letting it fall to the floor. And he reached up, as he always did, and put his hands on her breasts as she worked herself on him. He was hard now, and she guided him into her and felt him shudder. Neither of them uttered a sound. And she looked down through the darkness at this good man who had known her for so long, and saw in his eyes, unobscured by desire, an awful, irretrievable sadness. The weather turned colder on Christmas Day. Metallic clouds whipped over the woods like a film in Fast Forward, and the wind shifted to the north and brought Arctic air spiraling down the valley. Inside, they listened to it howling in the chimney as they sat playing Scrabble by the big log fire. That morning, opening presents around the tree, they had all tried hard. Never in her life, not even when very young, had Grace had so many presents. Almost everyone they knew had sent her something, and Annie had realized too late that they should have kept some back. Grace, she could see, sensed charity, and left many gifts unopened. Annie and Robert hadn't known what to buy her. In recent years, it had always been something to do with riding. Now everything they could think of carried an implication simply through not being to do with riding. In the end, Robert had bought her a tank of tropical fish. They knew she wanted one, but Annie feared even this had a message tagged to it. "Sit and watch," it seemed to say. "This now is all you can do." Robert had rigged it all up in the little back parlor and put Christmas wrapping paper on it. They led Grace to it and watched her face light up as she undid it.
"Oh, my God," she said. "That is just fabulous."
In the evening, when Annie finished tidying away the supper things, she found Grace and Robert in front of it, lying on the sofa in the dark. The tank was illuminated and bubbling, and the two of them had been watching it and fallen asleep in each other's arms. The swaying plants and the gliding shadows of the fish made ghostly patterns on their faces. At breakfast the next morning, Grace looked very pale. Robert put his hand on hers. "Are you okay, baby?" She nodded. Annie came back to the table with a jug of orange juice, and Robert took his hand away. Annie could see Grace had something difficult to say.
"I've been thinking about Pilgrim," she said in a level voice.
It was the first time the horse had been mentioned. Annie and Robert sat very still. Annie felt ashamed neither of them had been to see him since the accident, or at least since he had come back to Mrs. Dyer's.
"Aha," said Robert.
"And?"
"And I think we should send him back to Kentucky."
There was a pause. "Gracie," Robert began, "we don't need to make decisions right now. It may be that Grace cut him off.
I know what you're going to say, that people who have had injuries like mine do ride again, but I don't..."
She broke off for a moment, composing herself.
"I don't want to. Please."
Annie looked at Robert, and she could tell he felt her eyes were on him, daring him to show even a hint of tears.
"I don't know if they'll take him back," Grace went on, "but I don't want anyone around here to have him."
Robert nodded slowly, showing he understood, even if he didn't yet agree. Grace latched on to this.
"I want to say goodbye to him, Daddy. Could we go see him this morning before I go back to the hospital?"
Annie had spoken just once to Harry Logan. It had been an awkward call, and though neither mentioned her threat to sue him, it had hung heavily over their every word. Logan had been charming, and in her tone at least, Annie got as near to an apology as she ever got. But since then, her news of Pilgrim had come only through Liz Hammond. Not wanting to add unduly to their worries over Grace, Liz had given Annie a picture of the horse's recovery that was as reassuring as it was false. The wounds were healing well, she said. The skin grafts over the cannon bone had taken. The nasal bone repair looked better than they had ever dared hope. None of these was a lie, and none of them prepared Annie, Robert, and Grace for what they were about to see as they came up the long drive and parked in front of Joan Dyer's house. Mrs. Dyer came out of the stable and crossed the yard toward them, wiping her hands on the sides of the old blue quilt jacket she always wore. The wind whipped strands of gray hair across her face, and she smiled as she tidied them away. The smile was so odd and out of character that Annie was puzzled. It was probably just awkwardness at the sight of Grace being helped out onto her crutches by Robert.
"Hello, Grace," Mrs. Dyer said. "How are you, dear?"
"She's doing just great, aren't you, baby?" Robert said.
"Why can't he let her answer for herself?" thought Annie.
Grace smiled bravely.
"Yes, I'm fine."
"Did you have a good Christmas? Lots of presents?"
"Zillions," said Grace. "We had a fabulous time, didn't we?"
She looked at Annie. "Fabulous," Annie endorsed. No one seemed to know what to say next, and for a moment they all stood there in the cold wind, embarrassed. Clouds barreled furiously overhead, and the red walls of the barn were suddenly set ablaze by a burst of sun.
"Grace wants to see Pilgrim," said Robert.
"Is he in the barn?" Mrs. Dyer's face flickered. "No,
he's out back."
Annie sensed something was wrong and could see Grace did, too.
"Great," said Robert. "Can we go see him?"
Mrs. Dyer hesitated, but only for an instant.
"Of course."
She turned and walked off. They followed her out of the yard and around the old row of stalls at the back of the barn.
"Mind how you go. It's pretty muddy back here."
She looked over her shoulder at Grace on her crutches, then darted a look at Annie. It felt like a warning.
"She's pretty darn good on those things, don't you think, Joan?" Robert said. "I can't keep up."
"Yes, I can see. Mrs. Dyer smiled briefly.
"Why isn't he in the barn?"
Grace asked. Mrs. Dyer didn't answer. They were at the stalls now, and she stopped by the only door that was closed and turned to face them. She swallowed hard and looked at Annie. "I don't know how much Harry and Liz have told you." Annie shrugged. "Well, we know he's lucky to be alive," Robert said. There was a pause. They were all waiting for Mrs. Dyer to go on. She seemed to be searching for the right words.
"Grace," she said, "Pilgrim isn't how he used to be. He's been very disturbed by what happened."
Grace looked very worried suddenly, and Mrs. Dyer looked at Annie and Robert for help.
"To be honest, I'm not sure it's a good idea for her to see him."
"Why?" "What?" Robert started to say, but Grace cut him off.
"I want to see him. Open the door."
Mrs. Dyer looked at Annie for a decision. It seemed to Annie that they had already gone too far to turn back. She nodded. Reluctantly, Mrs. Dyer drew back the bolt on the top half of the door. There was an immediate explosion of sound inside the stall, which startled them all. Then there was silence. Mrs. Dyer slowly opened the top door, and Grace peered in, with Annie and Robert standing behind her. It took a while for the girl's eyes to grow accustomed to the darkness. Then she saw him. Her voice when she spoke was so small and frail that the others could barely hear it.
"Pilgrim? Pilgrim?"
Then she gave a cry and turned away, and Robert had to reach out quickly to stop her from falling.
"No! Daddy, no!"
He put his arms around her and led her back to the yard. The sound of her sobbing faded and was lost on the wind.
"Annie," Mrs. Dyer said, "I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have let her."
Annie looked at her blankly, then stepped closer to the door of the stall. The smell of urine hit her in a sudden, pungent wave, and she could see the floor was filthy with dung. Pilgrim was backed into the shadow of the far corner, watching her. His feet were splayed, and his neck stretched so low that his head was little more than a foot above the ground. His grotesquely scarred muzzle was tilted up at her, as if daring her to move, and he was panting in short, nervy snorts. Annie felt a shiver at the nape of her neck, and the horse seemed to sense it too, for now he pinned back his ears and leered at her in a toothy, gothic parody of threat. Annie looked into his eyes with their blood-crazed whites, and for the first time in her life knew how one might come to believe in the devil. Chapter 5. The meeting had been dragging on for almost an hour, and Annie was bored. There were people perched all around her office, locked in a fierce and esoteric debate about which particular shade of pink would look best on an upcoming cover. The competing mock-ups were laid out before them. Annie thought they all looked vile.
"I just don't think our readers are day-glow kind of people,"
somebody was saying. The art director, who clearly did think so, was getting more and more defensive.
"It isn't day-glow," he said. "It's electric candy."
"Well, I don't think they're electric candy people either. It's too 80s.
80s? That's absurd."
Annie would normally have cut it short long before it got to this. She would simply have told them what she thought, and that would have been that. The problem was she was finding it almost impossible to concentrate, and more worryingly, to care. It had been the same all morning. First, there had been a breakfast meeting to make peace with a Hollywood agent whose black hole client had gone berserk at having his profile canceled. Then she'd had the production people in her office for 2 hours, spreading doom about the soaring cost of paper. One of them had been wearing a cologne of such dizzying awfulness that Annie had needed to open all the windows afterward. She could still smell it now. In recent weeks, she had come to rely more than ever on her friend and deputy, Lucy Friedman, the magazine's resident style guru. The cover they were now discussing was tied to a piece Lucy had commissioned on lounge lizards and featured a grinning photograph of a perennial rock star whose wrinkles had already been contractually removed by computer. Sensing no doubt that Annie's mind was elsewhere, Lucy was effectively chairing the meeting. She was a big, pugnacious woman with a wicked sense of humor and a voice like a rusty car muffler. She enjoyed turning things upside down and did it now by changing her mind and saying the background shouldn't be pink at all but fluorescent lime green. As the argument raged, Annie drifted off again. In an office across the street, a man wearing spectacles and a business suit was standing by the window doing some kind of Tai Chi routine. Annie watched the precise, dramatic swooping of his arms and how still he kept his head, and she wondered what it did for him. Something caught her eye, and she saw through the glass panel by the door that Anthony, her assistant, was mouthing and pointing at his watch. It was nearly noon, and she was supposed to be meeting Robert and Grace at the orthopedic clinic. "What do you think, Annie?" Lucy said.
"Sorry, Luce, what was that?"
"Lime green with pink cover lines."
"Sounds great."
The art director muttered something that Annie chose to ignore. She sat forward and laid her hands flat on the desk.
"Listen, can we wind this up now? I have to be somewhere."
There was a car waiting for her, and she gave the driver the address and sat in the back, hunched inside her coat, as they wove across to the east side and headed uptown. The streets and those who walked them looked gray and dreary. It was that season of gloom when the new year had been in long enough for all to see it was just as bad as the old one. Waiting at the lights, Annie watched two derelicts huddled in a doorway, one sleeping while the other declaimed grandly to the sky. Her hands felt cold, and she shoved them deeper into her coat pockets. They passed Lester's, the coffee shop on 84th, where Robert used to take Grace for breakfast sometimes before school. They hadn't talked about school yet, but soon she would have to go back and face the stares of the other girls. It wasn't going to be easy, but the longer they left it, the tougher it would be. If the new leg fit all right, the one they were going to try today at the clinic, Grace would soon be walking. When she'd got the hang of it, she should go back to school. Annie got there 20 minutes late, and Robert and Grace were already in with Wendy Auerbach, the prosthetist. Annie declined the receptionist's offer to take her coat and was led down a narrow white corridor to the fitting room. She could hear their voices. The door was open, and none of them saw her come in. Grace was sitting in her panties on a bed. She was looking down at her legs, but Annie couldn't see them because the prosthetist was kneeling there adjusting something. Robert stood to one side, watching.
"How's that?" said the prosthetist. "Is that better?"
Grace nodded.
"All righty. Now, see how it feels standing."
She stood clear, and Annie watched Grace frown in concentration and ease herself slowly off the bed, wincing as the false leg took her weight. Then she looked up and saw Annie.
"Hi,"
she said, and did her best to smile. Robert and the prosthetist turned.
"Hi," Annie said. "How's it going?"
Grace shrugged.
"How pale she looked," thought Annie. "How frail." "The kid's a natural," said Wendy Auerbach. "Sorry we had to start without you, Mom."
Annie put up a hand to show she didn't mind. The woman's relentless jollity irritated her. All righty was bad enough. Calling her Mom was dicing with death. She was finding it difficult to take her eyes off the leg and was aware that Grace was studying her reaction. The leg was flesh-colored and, apart from the hinge and valve hole at the knee, a reasonable match for her left leg. Annie thought it looked hideous, outrageous. She didn't know what to say. Robert came to the rescue. "The new socket fits a treat." After the first fitting, they had taken another plaster mold of Grace's stump and fashioned this new and better socket. Robert's fascination with the technology had made the whole process easier. He had taken Grace into the workshop and asked so many questions, he probably now knew enough to be a prostheticist himself. Annie knew the purpose was to distract not just Grace but also himself from the horror of it all. But it worked, and Annie was grateful. Someone brought in a walking frame, and Robert and Annie watched Wendy Auerbach show Grace how to use it. This would only be needed for a day or two, she said, until Grace got the feel of the leg. Then she could just use a cane, and pretty soon she'd find she didn't even need that. Grace sat down again, and the prosthetist bounced through a list of maintenance and hygiene tips. She talked mainly to Grace, but tried to involve the parents, too. Soon this narrowed down to Robert, for it was he who asked the questions, and anyway she seemed to sense Annie's dislike. "All righty," she said eventually, clapping her hands. "I think we're done." She escorted them to the door. Grace kept the leg on, but walked with crutches. Robert carried the walking frame and a bag of things Wendy Auerbach had given them to look after the leg. He thanked her, and they all waited as she opened the door and offered Grace one last piece of advice. "Remember, there's hardly a thing you did before that you can't do now. So, young lady, you just get up on that darn horse of yours as soon as you can." Grace lowered her eyes. Robert put his hand on his shoulder. Annie shepherded them before her out of the door. "She doesn't want to," she said through her teeth as she went past, "and neither does the darn horse. All righty?" Pilgrim was wasting away. The broken bones and the scars on his body and legs had healed, but the damage done to the nerves in his shoulder had rendered him lame. Only a combination of confinement and physical therapy could help him. But such was the violence with which he exploded at anyone's approach that the latter was impossible without risk of serious injury. Confinement alone was thus his lot. In the dark stench of his stall, behind the barn where he had known days far happier, Pilgrim grew thin. Harry Logan had neither the courage nor the skill of Dorothy Chen in administering shots. And so Mrs. Dyer's boys devised a sly technique to help him. They cut a small sliding hatch in the bottom section of the door through which they pushed in Pilgrim's food and water. When a shot was due, they would starve him. With Logan standing ready with his syringe, they would put down pails of feed and water outside, then open the hatch. The boys would often get a fit of giggles as they hid to one side and waited for Pilgrim's hunger and thirst to get the better of his fear. When he reached tentatively out to sniff the pails, the boys would ram down the hatch and trap his head long enough for Logan to get the shot into his neck. Logan hated it. He especially hated the way the boys laughed. In early February, he called Liz Hammond, and they arranged to meet at the stables. They took a look at Pilgrim through the stall door and then went to sit in Liz's car. They sat in silence for a while, watching Tim and Eric hosing down the yard, fooling around. "I've had enough, Liz," Logan said. "It's all yours now."
"Have you spoken with Annie?"
"I called her 10 times. I told her a month ago the horse ought to be put down. She won't listen, but I tell you, I can't handle this anymore. Those two fucking kids drive me nuts. I'm a vet, Lizzie. I'm supposed to stop animals suffering, not make them suffer. I've had it." Neither of them spoke for a moment, just sat there, gravely assessing the boys. Eric was trying to light a cigarette, but Tim kept aiming the hose at him.
"She was asking me if there were horse psychiatrists," said Liz.
Logan laughed. "That horse doesn't need a shrink, he needs a lobotomy." He thought for a while. "There's this horse chiropractic guy over in Pittsfield, but he doesn't do cases like this." "Can't think of anybody who does, can you?"
Liz shook her head.
"There was no one." Logan sighed. The whole thing, he concluded, had been one goddamn miserable fuck-up from the start. And there was no sign he could see of it getting any better.
Part 2. Chapter 6. It was in America that horses first roamed. 1,000,000 years before the birth of man, they grazed the vast plains of wiry grass and crossed to other continents over bridges of rock soon severed by retreating ice. They first knew man as the hunted knows the hunter, for long before he saw them as a means to killing other beasts, man killed them for their meat. Paintings on the walls of caves showed how. Lions and bears would turn and fight, and that was the moment men speared them. But the horse was a creature of flight, not fight, and with a simple, deadly logic, the hunter used flight to destroy it. Whole herds were driven, hurtling headlong to their deaths from the tops of cliffs. Deposits of their broken bones bore testimony. And though later he came pretending friendship, the alliance with man would ever be but fragile, for the fear he'd struck into their hearts was too deep to be dislodged.
Since that Neolithic moment when first a horse was haltered, there were those among men who understood this. They could see into the creature's soul and soothe the wounds they found there. Often they were seen as witches, and perhaps they were. Some wrought their magic with the bleached bones of toads plucked from moonlit streams. Others, it was said, could with but a glance root the hooves of a working team to the earth they plowed. There were gypsies and showmen, shamans and charlatans, and those who truly had the gift were wont to guard it wisely, for it was said that he who drove the devil out might also drive him in. The owner of a horse you calmed might shake your hand, then dance around the flames while they burned you in the village square. For secrets uttered softly into pricked and troubled ears, these men were known as whisperers. They were mainly men, it seemed, and this puzzled Annie as she read by hooded lamplight in the cavernous reading room of the public library. She had assumed that women would know more about such things than men. She sat for many hours at one of the long, gleaming mahogany tables, privately corralled by the book she had found, and she stayed until the place closed. She read about an Irishman called Sullivan, who lived 200 years ago and whose taming of furious horses had been witnessed by many. He would lead the animals away into a darkened barn, and no one knew for sure what happened when he closed the door. He claimed that all he used were the words of an Indian charm, bought for the price of a meal from a hungry traveler. No one ever knew if this was true, for his secret died with him. All the witnesses knew was that when Sullivan led the horses out again, all fury had vanished. Some said they looked hypnotized by fear. There was a man from Groveport, Ohio, called John Solomon Rary, who tamed his first horse at the age of 12. Word of his gift spread, and in 1858 he was summoned to Windsor Castle in England to calm a horse of Queen Victoria. The Queen and her entourage watched astonished as Rary put his hands on the animal and laid it down on the ground before them. Then he lay down beside it and rested his head on its hooves. The Queen chuckled with delight and gave Rary $100. He was a modest, quiet man, but now he was famous, and the press wanted more. The call went out to find the most ferocious horse in all England. It was duly found. He was a stallion by the name of Cruiser, once the fastest racehorse in the land. Now, though, according to the account Annie read, he was a fiend incarnate and wore an 8-pound iron muzzle to stop him killing too many stable boys. His owners only kept him alive because they wanted to breed from him, and to make him safe enough to do this, they planned to blind him. Against all advice, Rary let himself into the stable where no one else dared venture, and shut the door. He emerged 3 hours later, leading Cruiser without his muzzle and gentle as a lamb. The owners were so impressed, they gave him the horse. Rary brought him back to Ohio, where Cruiser died on July 6, 1875, outliving his new master by a full 9 years. Annie came out of the library and down between the massive lions that guarded the steps to the street. Traffic blared by and the wind funneled icily up the canyon of buildings. She still had 3 or 4 hours of work to do back at the office, but she didn't take a cab. She wanted to walk. The cold air might make sense of the stories swirling in her head. Whatever their names, no matter where or when they lived, the horses she had read about all had but one face. Pilgrims. It was into pilgrims' ears that the Irishman intoned, and they were pilgrims' eyes behind the iron muzzle. Something was happening to Annie which she couldn't yet define. Something visceral. Over the past month, she had watched her daughter walking the floors of the apartment, first with the frame, then with the cane. She had helped Grace, they all had, with the brutal, boring, daily slog of physical therapy, hour upon hour of it, till their limbs ached as much as hers.
Physically, there was a steady accumulation of tiny triumphs. But Annie could see that in almost equal measure, something inside the girl was dying. Grace tried to mask it from them, her parents, Elsa, her friends, even the army of counselors and therapists who were paid well to see such things, with a kind of dogged cheerfulness. But Annie saw through it, saw the way Grace's face went when she thought no one was looking, and saw silence like a patient monster enfold her daughter in its arms. Quite why the life of a savage horse slammed up in a squalid country stall should seem now so crucially linked with her daughter's decline, Annie had no idea. There was no logic to it. She respected Grace's decision not to ride again. Indeed, Annie didn't like the idea of her even trying. And when Harry Logan and Liz told her again and again that it would be kinder to destroy Pilgrim and that his prolonged existence was a misery to all concerned, she knew they were talking sense. Why then did she keep saying no? Why, when the magazine's circulation figures had started to level out, had she just taken two whole afternoons off to read about weirdos who whispered into animals' ears? Because she was a fool, she told herself. Everyone was going home when she got back to the office. She settled at her desk, and Anthony gave her a list of messages and reminded her about a breakfast meeting she had been trying to avoid. Then he said good night and left her on her own. Annie made a couple of calls that he'd said couldn't wait, then called home. Robert told her that Grace was doing her exercises. She was fine, he said. It was what he always said. Annie told him she would be late and to go ahead and eat without her. You sound tired, he said. Heavy day?
No, I spent it reading about whisperers.
About what?
I'll tell you later.
She started to go through the stack of papers Anthony had left for her, but her thoughts kept sliding away into far-fetched fantasies about what she'd read in the library. Maybe John Rary had a great-great-grandson somewhere who'd inherited the gift and could use it on Pilgrim. Maybe she could place an ad in the Times to trace him. Whisperer wanted. How long it was before she fell asleep, she had no idea, but she woke with a start to see a security man standing at the door. He was doing a routine check of the offices and apologized for disturbing her. Annie asked him what time it was and was shocked to hear it was past 11. She called for a car and slouched dismally in the back as it took her all the way up Central Park West. The apartment building's green door canopy looked colorless in the sodium glow of the street lamps. Robert and Grace had both gone to bed. Annie stood in the doorway of Grace's room and let her eyes get used to the dark. The false leg stood in the corner like a toy sentry. Grace shifted in her sleep and murmured something. And the thought suddenly occurred to Annie that perhaps this need she felt to keep Pilgrim alive, to find someone who could calm his troubled heart, wasn't about Grace at all. Perhaps it was about herself. Annie softly pulled the covers up over Grace's shoulder and walked back along the corridor to the kitchen. Robert had left a note on the yellow pad on the table. Liz Hammond had called, it said. She had the name of someone who might be able to help. Chapter 7. Tom Booker woke at 6 and listened to the local news on the TV while he shaved. A guy from Oakland had parked in the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge, shot his wife and 2 kids, and then jumped off. Traffic both ways was at a standstill. In the eastern suburbs, a woman out jogging in the hills behind her home had been killed by a mountain lion. The light above the mirror made his sunburnt face look green against the shaving foam. The bathroom was dingy and cramped, and Tom had to stoop to stand under the shower rigged in the bathtub. It always seemed motels like this were built for some miniature race you never came across, People with tiny, nimble fingers who actually preferred soap the size of credit cards and wrapped for their convenience. He dressed and sat on the bed to pull his boots on, looking out over the little parking lot that was crammed with the pickups and four-wheeler trucks of those coming to the clinic. As of last night, there were going to be 20 in the colt class and about the same in the horsemanship class. It was too many, but he never liked turning folk away, for their horses' sake more than theirs. He put on his green wool jacket, picked up his hat, and let himself out into the narrow concrete corridor that led to reception. The young Chinese manager was putting out a tray of evil-looking donuts by the coffee machine. He beamed at Tom.
"Morning, Mr. Booker. How you doing?"
"Good, thanks," Tom said. He put his key down on the desk. "How are you?"
"Fine. A complimentary donut."
"No, thanks."
"All set for the clinic?"
"Oh, reckon we'll muddle through. See you later."
"Bye, Mr. Booker."
The dawn air felt damp and chilly as he walked toward his pickup, but the cloud was high and Tom knew it would burn off by mid-morning. Back home in Montana, the ranch was still under 2 foot of snow, but when they drove into Marin County here last night, it had felt like spring. California, he thought. They sure had it all worked out down here, even the weather. He couldn't wait to get home. He pointed the red Chevy out onto the highway and looped back over 101. The riding center nestled in a gently sloping wooded valley a couple of miles out of town. He had brought the trailer up here last night before checking into the motel and turned Rimrock out into the meadow. Tom saw someone had already been out putting arrow signs up along the route saying Booker Horse Clinic and wished whoever it was hadn't. If the place was harder to find, maybe some of the dumber ones wouldn't show up. He drove through the gate and parked on the grass near the big arena where the sand had been watered and neatly combed. There was no one about. Rimrock saw him from the far side of the meadow, and by the time Tom got over to the fence, he was there waiting. He was an 8-year-old brown quarter horse with a white blaze on his face and 4 neat white socks, that gave him the dapper look of someone dressed up for a tennis party. Tom had bred and reared him himself. He rubbed the horse's neck and let him nuzzle the side of his face. "You got your work cut out today, old son," Tom said. Normally he liked to have 2 horses at a clinic so they could share the load, but his mare, Bronte, was about to foal and he'd had to leave her back in Montana. That was another reason he wanted to get home. Tom turned and leaned against the fence, and the two of them silently surveyed the empty space that for the next 5 days would be buzzing with nervous horses and their more nervous owners. After he and Rimrock had worked with them, most would go home a little less nervous, and that made it worth doing. But this was the 4th clinic in about as many weeks, and seeing the same damn fool problems cropping up time and time again got kind of wearing. For the first time in 20 years, he was going to take the spring and summer off. No clinics, no traveling, just stay put on the ranch, get some of his own colts going, help his brother some. That was it. Maybe he was getting too old. He was 45. Hell, nearly 46. When he'd started out doing clinics, he could do 1 a week all year round and love every minute. If only the people could be as smart as the horses. Rona Williams, the woman who owned the center and hosted this clinic every year, had seen him and was coming down from the stables. She was a small, wiry woman with the eyes of a zealot, and though pushing 40, wore her hair in 2 long plaits. The girlishness of this was contradicted by the manly way she walked. It was the walk of someone used to being obeyed. Tom liked her. She worked hard to make a success of the clinic. He touched his hat to her, and she smiled, then looked up at the sky. "Gonna be a good one," she said. "I reckon." Tom nodded toward the road. "I see you got yourself some nice new signs out there, in case any of these 40 crazy horses get themselves lost."
39.
"Oh, someone drop out?"
"Nope. 39 horses, 1 donkey."
She grinned.
"Guy who owns it's an actor or something, coming up from L.A.
He sighed and gave her a look. "You're a ruthless woman, Rona. You'll have me wrestling grizzly bears before you're through."
It's an idea.
They walked down to the arena together and talked the schedule through. He would kick off this morning with the Colts, working with them one by one. With 20 of them, that was going to take pretty much the whole day. Tomorrow would be the horsemanship class, with some cattle work later, if there was time for those who wanted it. Tom had bought some new speakers and wanted to do a sound test, so Rona helped him get them out of the Chevy, and they set them up near the bleachers where the spectators would sit. The speakers squealed with feedback when they were switched on, then settled into a menacing, anticipatory hum as Tom walked out across the virgin sand of the arena and spoke into the radio mic of his headset. "Hi, folks," his voice boomed among the trees that stood unstirring in the still air of the valley. "This is the Rona Williams Show, and I'm Tom Booker, donkey tamer to the stars." When they'd checked everything through, they drove down into town to the place they always had breakfast. Smokey and TJ, the two young guys Tom had brought from Montana to help with this run of four clinics, were already eating. Rona ordered granola, and Tom some scrambled eggs, wheat toast, and a large orange juice. "You hear about that woman killed by a mountain lion out jogging?" said Smokey. "The lion was jogging too?" Tom asked, all big blue-eyed innocence. Everyone laughed. "Why not?" said Rona. "Hey, fellas, it's California."
"That's right," said TJ. "They say he was all in Lycra and wearing those little earphones."
"You mean one of them Sony Pro men?" said Tom. Smokey waited for them to finish, taking it well. Teasing him had become the morning game. Tom was fond of him. He wasn't a Nobel Prize winner, but when it came to horses, he had something going for him. One day, if he worked at it, he'd be good. Tom reached out and ruffled his hair. "You're okay, Smoke," he said. A pair of buzzards circled lazily against the liquid blue of the afternoon sky. They floated ever upward on the thermals that rose from the valley, filling that middle space between tree and hilltop with an eerie, intermittent mewing. 500 feet below, in a cloud of dust, the latest of the day's 20 dramas was unfolding. The sun and maybe the signs along the road had lured as big a crowd as Tom had ever seen here. The bleachers were packed and people were still coming in, paying their $10 a head to one of Rona's helpers at the gate. The women running the refreshment stall were doing brisk business, and the air was laced with the smell of barbecue. In the middle of the arena stood a small corral, some 30 feet across, and it was here that Tom and Rimrock were working. The sweat was starting to streak the dust on Tom's face, and he wiped it on the sleeve of his faded blue snap-button shirt. His legs felt hot under the old leather chaps he wore over his jeans. He'd done 11 colts already, and this now was the 12th, a beautiful black thoroughbred. Tom always started by having a word with the owner to find out the horse's history, as he liked to call it. Had he been ridden yet? Were there any special problems? There always were, but more often than not, it was the horse who told you what they were, not the owner. This little thoroughbred was a case in point. The woman who owned him said he had a tendency to buck and was reluctant to move out. He was lazy, cranky even, she said. But now that Tom and Rimrock had him circling around them in the corral, the horse was saying something different. Tom always gave a running commentary into the radio mic so the crowd could follow what he was doing. He tried not to make the owner sound foolish, too foolish anyway. "There's another story coming through here," he said. "It's always kind of interesting to hear the horse's side of the story. Now, if he was cranky or lazy, like you say, we'd be seeing the tail twitching there and his ears back, maybe. But this isn't a cranky horse, it's a scared horse. You see how braced he is there?" The woman was watching from outside the corral, leaning on the rail. She nodded. Tom had Rimrock turning on a dime in deft little white-socked steps, so he was always facing the circling thoroughbred. "And how he keeps pointing his hindquarters in at me? Well, I guess the reason he seems reluctant to move out is because when he does, he gets into trouble for it."
"He's not good at transitions," the woman said. "You know, when I want him to move from a trot to a lope, say?"
Tom had to bite his tongue when he heard this kind of talk. "Aha," he said. "That's not what I'm seeing. You may think you're asking for a lope, but your body's saying something else.
You're putting too many conditions on it. You're saying, go, but hey, don't go. Or maybe go, but not too fast. He knows this from the way you feel. Your body can't lie. You ever give him a kick to make him move out?
He won't go unless I do.
And then he goes, and you feel he's going too fast, so you yank him back?
Well, yes, sometimes.
Sometimes. And then he bucks. She nodded. He said nothing for a while. The woman had got the message and was starting to look defensive. She was clearly big on image, made up like Barbara Stanwyck with all the right gear. The hat alone must have set her back $300. God knows what the horse cost. Tom worked on getting the thoroughbred focused on him. He had 60 foot of coiled rope, and he threw it so the coils slapped against the horse's flank, making it burst into a lope. He coiled the rope back in, then did it again. Then again, and again, making the animal go from a trot to a lope, letting it slow, then up to a lope again. "I want him to get so he can leave real soft," he said. "He's getting the idea now. He's not all braced up and tense like he was at the start. See the way his hindquarters are straightening out? And how his tail's not clamped in all tight like it was? He's finding out it's okay to go." He threw the rope again, and this time the transition to the lope was smooth. "You see that? That's a change. He's getting better already. Pretty soon, if you work at it, you'll be able to make all these transitions easy on a loose rein." And pigs will fly, he thought. She'll take the poor animal home, ride him just as she always did, and all this work will have been for nothing. The thought, as always, moved him up a gear. If he fixed the horse real good, maybe he could immunize the poor thing against her stupidity and fear. The thoroughbred was moving out nicely now, but Tom had only worked on one side, so he turned him around to make him run the other way and did the whole thing over again. It took almost an hour. By the time he finished, the thoroughbred was sweating hard, but when Tom let him ease up and come to a standstill, the horse looked kind of disappointed. "He could go on playing all day," said Tom. "Hey, mister, can I have my ball back?" The crowd laughed. "He's gonna be okay, as long as you don't go yanking on him." He looked at the woman. She nodded and tried to smile, but Tom could see she was crestfallen, and he suddenly felt sorry for her. He walked Rimrock over to where she stood and switched off the radio mic so only she could hear when he spoke. "It's all about self-preservation," he said gently. "You see, these animals have got such big hearts. There's nothing they want more than to do what you want them to. But when the messages get confused, all they can do is try and save themselves." He smiled down at her for a moment, then said, "Now why don't you go saddle him up and see?" The woman was close to tears. She climbed over the rail and walked over to her horse. The little thoroughbred watched her all the way. He let her come right up and stroke his neck. Tom watched. "He's not going to look back if you don't," he said. "They're the most forgiving creatures God ever made." She led the horse out, and Tom brought Rimrock slowly back to the middle of the corral, letting the silence hold for a while. He took off his hat, squinting at the sky as he wiped the sweat from his brow. The two buzzards were still hanging there. Tom thought how mournful their mewing sounded. He put his hat back on and flicked the switch of the radio mic. "Okay, folks, who's next?" It was the guy with the donkey. Chapter 8. It was more than 100 years since Joseph and Alice Booker, Tom's great-grandparents, made their long journey west to Montana, lured like thousands of others by the promise of land. The passage cost them the lives of 2 children, one from scarlet fever and the other drowned, but they made it as far as the Clark's Fork River and there staked a claim to 160 fertile acres. By the time Tom was born, the ranch they started had grown to 20,000 acres. That it had so prospered, let alone endured the ruthless round of drought, flood, and felony, was mainly due to Tom's grandfather, John. It was at least logical, therefore, that it should be he who destroyed it.
John Booker, a man of great physical strength and even greater gentleness, had two sons. Above the ranch house that had long since replaced the tarred homesteader's shack stood a rocky bluff where the boys played hiding games and looked for arrowheads. From its crest you could see the river curving around like a castle moat, and in the distance the snowy peaks of the Pryor and Beartooth Mountains. Sometimes the boys would sit there side by side without talking and look out across their father's land. What the younger boy saw was his entire world. Daniel, Tom's father, loved the ranch with all his heart, and if ever his thoughts strayed beyond its boundaries, it was only to reinforce the feeling that all he wanted lay within them. To him, the distant mountains were like comforting walls, protecting all he held dear from the turbulence beyond. To Ned, 3 years his senior, they were the walls of a prison. He couldn't wait to escape, and when he was 16, he duly did. He went to California to seek his fortune, and lost a gullible succession of business partners theirs instead. Daniel stayed and ran the ranch with his father. He married a girl called Ellen Hooper from Bridger, and they had three children, Tom, Rosie, and Frank. Much of the land John had added to those original riverside acres was poorer pasture, rough, sage-strewn hills of red gumbo gashed with black volcanic rock. The cattle work was done on horseback, and Tom could ride almost before he could walk. His mother used to like telling how at 2 years old they'd found him in the barn, curled up in the straw, asleep between the massive hooves of a Percheron stallion. It was as though the horse was guarding him, she said. They used to halter break their colts as yearlings in the spring, and the boy would sit on the top rail of the corral and watch. Both his father and his grandfather had a gentle way with the horses, and he didn't discover till later that there was any other way. "It's like asking a woman to dance," the old man used to say. "If you've got no confidence and you're scared she's going to turn you down, and you sidle up looking at your boots, sure as eggs will break, she'll turn you down. Of course, then you can try grabbing her and forcing her around the floor, but neither one of you is going to end up enjoying it a whole lot." His grandfather was a great dancer. Tom could remember him gliding with his grandmother under the strings of colored lights at the 4th of July dance. Their feet seemed to be on air. It was the same when he rode a horse. "Dancing and riding, it's the same damn thing," he would say. "It's about trust and consent. You've gotten hold of one another. The man's leading, but he's not dragging her. He's offering a feel, and she feels it and goes with him. You're in harmony and moving to each other's rhythm, just following the feel." These things Tom knew already, though knew not how he came to know them. He understood the language of horses in the same way he understood the difference between colors or smells. At any moment he could tell what was going on in their heads, and he knew it was mutual. He started his first colt. He never used the word break, when he was just 7. Tom's grandparents died the same winter, one swiftly following the other, when Tom was 12. John left the ranch in its entirety to Tom's father. Ned flew up from Los Angeles to hear the will read out. He had been back rarely, and Tom only remembered him for his fancy two-tone shoes and the hunted look he had in his eyes. He always called him Bud and brought some useless gift, a piece of frippery that was the current craze of city kids. This time he left without saying a word. Instead, they heard from his lawyers. The litigation dragged on for 3 years. Tom would hear his mother crying in the night. The kitchen always seemed full of lawyers and real estate people and neighbors who smelled money. Tom turned away from all this and lost himself in the horses. He would cut school to be with them, and his parents were too preoccupied either to notice or care. The only time he remembered his father happy during this time was in the spring, when for 3 days they drove the cattle up to the summer pastures. His mother, Frank, and Rosie came too, and the 5 of them would ride all day and sleep out under the stars. "If only you could make now last forever,"
Frank said on one of those nights, while they lay on their backs watching a huge half-moon roar up out of the dark shoulders of the mountain. Frank was 11 and not by nature a philosopher. They had all lain still, thinking about this for a while. Somewhere a long way off, a coyote called. "I guess that's all forever is," his father replied. "Just one long trail of nows. And I guess all you can do is try and live one now at a time, without getting too worked up about the last now or the next now." It seemed to Tom as good a recipe for life as he'd yet heard. 3 years of lawsuits left his father a broken man. The ranch ended up sold to an oil company, and the money that remained after the lawyers and the tax man had taken their cut was split in half. Ned was never seen or heard of again. Daniel and Ellen took Tom, Rosie, and Frank and moved away west. They bought 7,000 acres in an old sprawl of a ranch house on the Rocky Mountain front. It was where the high plains ran smack into a 100-million-year-old wall of limestone. A place of harsh, towering beauty, which later Tom would come to love. But he wasn't ready for it. His real home had been sold from under him, and he wanted to be off on his own. Once he had helped his parents get the new ranch going, he upped and left. He went down to Wyoming and worked as a hired hand. There he saw things he would never have believed. Cowboys who whipped and spurred their horses till they bled. At a ranch near Sheridan, he saw for himself why they called it breaking a horse. He watched a man tie a yearling tight by its neck to a fence, hobble a hind leg, then beat it into submission with a length of zinc piping. Tom would never forget the fear in the animal's eyes, nor the stupid triumph in the man's when many hours later it sought to save its life and submitted to the saddle. Tom told the man he was a fool, got into a fight, and was fired on the spot. He moved to Nevada and worked some of the big ranches there. Wherever he worked, he made a point of seeking out the most troubled horses and offering to ride them. Many of the men he rode with had been doing the job since long before he was born, and to begin with, they would snigger behind their hands at the sight of him mounting some crazy beast that had thrown the best of them a dozen times. They soon stopped, though, when they saw the way the boy handled himself and how the horse changed. Tom lost count of the horses he met who had been seriously screwed up by the stupidity or cruelty of humans, but he never met one he couldn't help. For 5 years, this was his life. He came home when he could and always tried to be there for the times his father most needed help. For Ellen, these visits were like a series of snapshots plotting her son's progression into manhood. He had grown lean and tall, and of her three children, by far the best looking. He wore his sun-bleached hair longer than before, and she chided him for it, but secretly liked it. Even in winter, his face was tanned, and it made the clear, pale blue of his eyes all the more vivid. The life he described seemed to his mother a lonely one. There were friends, he mentioned, but none who were close. There were girls he dated, but none he was serious about. By his own account, most of the time that he wasn't working with horses, he spent reading and studying for a correspondence course he'd signed up for. Ellen noticed he'd grown quieter, how he spoke now only when he had something to say. Unlike his father, however, there was nothing sad about this quietness. It was more a kind of focused stillness.
This ends Disc 3.